Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Terence McKenna, the leading advocate of psychedelic drugs, became for today's guest both an obsession and a revitalizing force. In his first book-length work of nonfiction, our guest charts his recovery from pharmaceutical drugs and his surprising and positive change in worldview with the help of psilocybin, DMT, salvia, and cannabis. In exploring these ideas and detailing his experiences with them, our author takes readers on a trip through nature, his own past, psychedelic culture, and the unknown. Our guest today is Tao Lin, author of the new book, Trip, Psychedelics, Alienation, and Change. He is the author of the novels Taipei and Richard Yates, the novella Shoplifting from American Apparel, as well as collections of poetry and short stories. Tao was born in Virginia, has taught at Sarah Lawrence College MFA program, and is the founder and editor of Moo Moo House. Hello, Tao, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Thank you for having me on.
This book, Trip, is kind of a departure from the novel writing that you're most known for. This is nonfiction, and it's a bit odd, I must say. How would you describe it, and how did it come about?
It is a bit odd because my first 10 years writing, I wrote almost entirely autobiographical fiction about feeling depressed and meaningless and confused. And I got really deep into that. And in 2013, I published this novel called Taipei, where I continued exploring those themes, which I also felt in my own life. I felt depressed, meaningless, unable to find something that could sustain my interest and keep giving me meaning. And then the day that I finished the main final draft of that novel, Taipei, I encountered Terence McKenna on YouTube for the first time. I'd never even heard of him. Mm-hmm. And his view of the world seemed like the opposite of mine. And yet I found it extremely compelling. And his idea that first excited me most was the end of history. His idea that, or more his observation, that life started with single cells and gradually complexified at an exponential rate. And something like that seems like it'll lead to humans leaving the universe, possibly to the imagination. And that really excited me, partly because before Terence McKenna, my worldview, I would say, was I vaguely subscribed to existentialism. Mm-hmm. Which said that I lived in an indifferent universe and I had to find my own meaning. And then Terence McKenna, besides the end of history, he also corrected Sartre, because Sartre said nature is mute, but Terence McKenna said obviously it's humans who are deaf.
Right.
And that made a lot of sense to me. So I began to look for outside of myself for meaning. Instead of just trying to create it myself, I look to nature,
right,
and history and deep time in all these books, because Terence McKenna was really known for reading a lot and promoting learning things yourself, and I really caught on to that, and I started reading a lot of nonfiction books.
Oh, there's so much knowledge in this book from so many different areas, you know, the history of culture, the history of human evolution, you know, a lot of stuff in there about drugs. There's so many different things, and we're not going to be able to get to them today. But getting back to this, why you wrote the book, you cite two reasons in the book. And here's a quote: "To me, the world remains a terrible place, worthy of all the negative attributes I've called it in the past. But I'm now gratefully convinced it's also awe-inspiring and excitingly bizarre and complicatedly magical, a place of easily accessible wonder and pervasive, explorable, feelable mystery. I want to explain why." So that's your first reason. You want to explain this transformation that you've gone through. And then the second reason is, "I've gradually realized that sustained conscious effort is required or at least strongly self-suggested, for me to not drift towards meaninglessness, depression, disempowering forms of resignation, and bleak ideologies like existentialism. This book is part of my effort, which is what you just said. So you had some very personal reasons for writing this book, and it really comes through. You know, as one reviewer put it, the book is not only a book about drugs, it's about the condition of humans at this point in history, troublingly divorced from our natural capacity for awe by our chemically depleted bodies and minds. Now, speaking of chemically depleted bodies and minds, your book is about your personal experience with drugs. And why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, when I was 26, I started using Adderall and Xanax and other pharmaceutical drugs.
Right.
I wasn't prescribed by a doctor. I just got them from friends, and I would use them in social situations to be more outgoing and be able to communicate better with people and at readings and stuff like that.
Right.
But using that, after just months of using that, I would start feeling terrible almost all the time unless I was on those drugs. And that continued for like 2 years, where I would keep trying to stop using those drugs, but I'll keep using more.
Right.
And then finally, I encountered Terrence McKenna. Then around 8 months later, I started smoking and or eating cannabis every day.
Right.
And stopped using the pharmaceutical drugs.
Uh-huh.
And using cannabis, I can be outgoing and intimate with people without the physical load of Adderall and Xanax. I don't feel terrible the next day.
So are you not doing Adderall and Xanax anymore?
No, I haven't done them in about 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Plus those drugs, it's just the active ingredient plus like 9 toxic ingredients.
Right, you mentioned that in the book. That's very revealing, yeah.
Yeah, with cannabis, I'm getting hundreds of compounds plus vitamins and amino acids and all these things.
And they're all organic.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there was a lot of research that went into this book, you know, where you're really helping the reader. You're offering some pretty good science when it comes to drugs and hallucinogens, which you differentiate. When you speak of drugs, you're talking about man-made synthetic things, right?
Yeah, synthetic compounds.
That's what the word drugs is defined as in your book.
Yeah.
Right. And so these other things, why do they, most people think about drugs and they lump in all the psychedelics that we mentioned earlier in the intro. But you don't do that. What do you, if they're not drugs, how do you look at them?
I view psychedelics also as drugs, but in this book, I found it really useful to just create these two categories, drugs and psychedelics. And drugs is everything I used before.
I see.
That I wanted to get away from.
Uh-huh.
But there is some overlap because LSD is a semi-synthetic compound, and
right.
I view that as a psychedelic, and I use it and benefit from it.
Now, speaking of cannabis, you mentioned in the book, and I thought this was interesting because I've had this experience, where cannabis seems to suppress dreams. And when you stop smoking cannabis, when I stopped smoking cannabis, I started having vivid dreams every night. And I hadn't remembered a dream in years before that. Is that good? I mean, aren't dreams a healthy thing to have?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's good or not. I imagine the dream energy gets transferred to when you're stoned and awake. So maybe you're just taking something from there and giving it to your normal life.
Okay.
And that's probably not good because I feel like when you're sleeping and dreaming, I've read that throughout the night, your dreams start off, like if you wake up in the middle of the night, you might remember a nightmare. But your mind works through it, and in the morning, you're in a better mood if you have all these dreams. I've read that.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so, you got so into Terrence that you wrote a weekly column for Vice called The Tao of Terrence.
Yeah, I was really obsessed.
Do you still do that?
No, that was just a 12-week column, and it eventually became this book.
Uh-huh.
How did you first learn of Terrence?
Through the I Ching. I was an I Ching author, and I published an I Ching software program in the early 90s, actually 1988. And he came out with the Time Wave Zero program, which leverages the I Ching, which you discuss in the book. I found that really great. And so when I developed a CD-ROM of the I Ching, which I called Oracle of Changes, and it was a product in the mid-90s, I wanted to add some value. This is when CD-ROMs seemed to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to tape some interviews. Like, I taped an interview with a woman who had the correlation, Katya Walters, who had the correlation between the 64 codons of DNA and the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching.
Oh, yeah, I've read her book.
Yeah.
What, Chaos something?
Yeah, I forget. It was a long time
ago. Yeah, I read that book, and I felt like there was a lot of astonishing information, but I couldn't understand it yet.
It's an astonishing correlation, for sure.
Yeah.
And then, and I wanted to do it with Terrence because I had been, Terrence was a customer of mine. He had my I Ching software. Mm. And I don't know whether he got in touch with me or I got in touch with him or how we originally contacted, but, you know, I wanted to, I told him I was making a CD-ROM version of something I'd already made on floppy disks years before called Synchronicity, which he had. So he had my original Macintosh program. Now I was making a CD-ROM, and I wanted to put some videotaped interviews on it. And we now feature that. My interview with Terrence McKenna in 1997 is featured through Divination.com's podcast section because we took the video out and we captured the audio. And like you said, it's really interesting. He's got a really fantastic take on the I Ching and the nature of time.
Yeah,
and the fractal nature of time. Amazing the way he broke it down. And I was so grateful to be able to meet him. I went to his place in Hawaii where he was evidently having an exotic garden, you know, growing things that might be in danger in the Amazon, that kind of thing. And it was a great privilege for me to meet him. I used to say about him, I think he has the widest bandwidth between the brain and the mouth of anybody I ever saw in my life.
Yeah, I heard that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, he's just was amazing. I loved him.
And you were already interested in psychedelics?
I'm an old hippie, and I took tons of psychedelics in the early 70s. Mm. So I, you know, probably took LSD 80 times. So I, you know, and psilocybin and mescaline. I had never taken ayahuasca at that point. But so, yeah, no, I found a lot of benefit in psychedelics, just like you have. But it was a long time ago. Mm. But, yeah, of course, he's the master. I read Food of the Gods and all of his books, just like you did. I, you know, I'm older and I got started earlier than you did. But,
Time wave theory seems really interesting to me, and I feel like sometimes it gets discounted.
The time wave theory?
Yeah, because people associated with his 2012.
Right. So it gets discounted because 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar, kind of was a dud.
Yeah.
Compared to what people wanted it to be, and he pointed to it as a possible end date, but he didn't. It wasn't contingent on that. He said it could be 50 years or 500 years off, you know?
Yeah, he said centuries to decades. But people just focus on that date.
Right.
And ignore that other thing he said.
Right, right. Now, he advocated psychedelics for shamanic exploration, personal growth work, and as a force that forces us to grow up and clean up. Has it done all these things for you?
It has. I've used it for all three of those things. Because for a long time, like I said, for 2 years, I wanted to stop using drugs. I didn't have the motivation or inspiration. I was just stuck in one place. And in the book, I talk about a psilocybin trip where I'm finally able to start doing those things immediately. And in that psilocybin trip, a lot of things happened, but I focused on this one message I got from it, which was leave society. And by that, I view leaving society as a relative term. Right now I live in New York City. If I just moved to some suburban or rural area, I'd be leaving society. And mostly for me, it's been a mental thing, leaving, consuming different culture, focusing on different things, and trying to find meaning outside of mainstream culture.
Right. You know, I love this quote from Terrence about this, where he says, "The reason we, which is in your book, the reason we feel alienated is because society is infantile, trivial, and stupid. So the cost of sanity in this society is a certain level of alienation. I grapple with this because I'm a parent, and I think anybody who has children, you come down to this realization, you know, what'll it be? Alienated, cynical intellectual? Or a slack-jawed, half-wit consumer of the horseshit being handed down from on high? There's not much choice in there, you see, and we all want our children to be well-adjusted. Unfortunately, there's nothing to be well-adjusted to. I think you took that to heart.
Yeah, I felt like there was nothing to be well-adjusted to for like 10 years. Or my entire life, actually. But I would always be trying. And then I found his worldview and in his references, and then later on Kathleen Harrison, his ex-wife, I felt like that was something I could adjust to, all this stuff. So I did find something.
I see. And one of the things you discovered with the help of Kathleen is the importance of this of an experience of awe as a source or as something that supports your sense of meaning.
Yeah, awe is something I never felt before psychedelics. Mainstream culture, the main association I had with the word awe was shock and awe.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a military strategy they used in Iraq.
Right.
But I had never felt it. But now on psychedelics and cannabis, I feel it often. Almost every day, I can feel awe or wonder.
And what does that do for you?
It inspires me a lot, and it allows me to, when I'm stoned enough and I feel a certain way, Terrence McKenna's ideas excite me a lot. Whereas if I'm feeling bad and on pharmaceutical drugs, it's harder to get excited about things like the end of history.
Right. Now, you challenge the sense behind labeling psychedelics as highly illegal controlled substances. Explain.
What did I say?
That you challenge that definition, or you challenge the illegality of them as controlled substances.
Well, I know they're illegal. It just doesn't make sense that they're illegal.
And why do you think they are illegal? You have a theory in the book.
Yeah, I quote Terrence McKenna saying that they're not illegal because the government's trying to protect us from us. They're illegal because they catalyze intellectual dissent. They make people start thinking things and questioning and wanting change.
Right. And they also somehow sensitize us to our goddess-worshipping partnership past.
Yeah, that's something I learned about from Terrence McKenna, because he often referenced the goddess. And then I finally looked into it. I read one of the books he referenced, The Chalice and the Blade by Rhian Eisler.
Right. We've had Rhian Eisler on Pathways 20 years ago or more.
Wow. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, her book was an international bestseller. It sold like a million copies, but I don't hear about it that much. I never heard about it in college, for example.
Right.
But from that, I learned this other view of history, which is that humans started in partnership societies. And they were egalitarian, and they worshipped female deities, and that deteriorated, culminating in the worst, probably around Jesus' birth and Christianity's rise. And then I view all since then as a recovery now. Whereas before, I thought no one knew what human history was like, but people assume it had always been male-dominated.
Right.
Because there's this other book I read published in 2015 called Sapiens. And this book was recommended by Barack Obama, Mark Zuckerberg, and Bill Gates. And that book doesn't mention the goddess religion at all or partnership societies. It doesn't mention any of the figurines that were found in the Upper Paleolithic. So it seems like mainstream culture doesn't have this knowledge of history, and it could help a lot right now.
Well, history didn't exist until writing was invented. Mm-hmm. Writing wasn't invented until like 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And so there was no history except as patriarchy developed it. I mean, as patriarchy developed writing and the ability to store writings and pass them down, the written word. Written word is so recent, partly because of technology, but partly because we just didn't. It was it's fairly recent invention.
Yeah, plus they would always be seeking out and destroying evidence of goddess worship and partnerships.
Right, right. The Bible was edited heavily against that. Right. Yeah.
The Bible didn't even mention the goddess. It referred to the goddess as Elohim, which is God.
So right. But there were goddesses like Ashtart and others that they persecuted.
Yeah.
Baal, B-A-A-L.
Yeah.
You know, then God says, go kill everybody who worships Baal.
Yeah.
And but they don't really make it clear in the Bible that it's a god, that it's a gender thing. Mm. But
And yeah. They call them pagans.
Right, of course. So, yeah, the only evidence we have of the way things were from before writing is archaeology.
Mm.
And as you point out in your book, in Çatalhöyük, in Asia Minor, which is now Turkey,
mm-hmm.
they discovered an 8,000-year-old settlement that had tombs intact,
mm-hmm.
and burial chambers intact, which is about the only thing that's going to last 8,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to determine that the largest chambers were for the high priestess, some feminine priestess person.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was a lot of figurines of deities,
mm-hmm.
and they were like 90% female deities.
Yeah.
And, you don't hear that mentioned a whole lot, you know. What was that like? You know, did we know that sex led to reproduction? There's so much we don't know about the vast expanse of human history, which, I don't know how old Homo sapiens is, do you?
Yeah, at least 280,000 years.
280,000, but then you say in the book, around 74,000 years ago, a volcano in Indonesia ejected 670 cubic miles of material over 9 to 14 days, and the largest explosive eruption in at least 19 million years, and the human population fell from around 100,000 to something between 2 and 8,000. Who probably found refuge in isolated tropical pockets, mainly equatorial Africa. And so it was only 72,000 years ago that a group of us left Africa, entering Eurasia. So I've never seen that information before.
I've never heard of the Mount Toba eruption either until I started researching this.
So were all the descendants of those 72,000, or the ones that 72,000 years ago, or all of us that are not just pure Africans are descended from the people that moved 72,000 years ago, and probably just a few thousand of them.
Yeah, probably. And they probably also bred a little with Neanderthals and other species that existed then.
Right, right, right. You know, I think it's interesting. I love this, you know. Sex at Dawn is another book that was written about how things changed, how we went from the hunter-gatherers. I mean, we were hunter-gatherers for 280,000 years.
Yeah.
Homo sapiens was hunter-gatherers, for nomadic, tribal, hunter-gatherers, sharing everything. Everything was communal. Nobody had any special technology that they didn't share. Nobody had private property. Private property hadn't been invented as a construct. Monetary systems hadn't been invented. Arithmetic for keeping track of property hadn't been invented. Writing for making laws about property. Thou shalt not covet my motorcycle or my wife or whatever. That's what writing was used for in the earliest times, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, even at Çatalhöyük, they still had all those things. All the buildings were the same size. There was no central, like, governmental control center or anything like that. And they had no signs of war for 1900 years.
Right.
And that was only excavated in 1961, I think. And I feel like it hasn't made it into schools, into textbooks or anything.
Right. Yeah. It's like, it's so important that we understand this, that maybe there was, like Rion Eisler says, that the genders were equal.
Yeah.
In the tribal nomadic days, and it's only been under patriarchy that women became property. Everything's about property. I think it's an obsession with property.
Yeah.
I hope you write a book about the invention of private property. I think it's fascinating, and it's the kind of thing that you do well. I learned a lot from from reading your book about various different things that were tangential to all this reading and study that you did at the behest of Terence McKenna.
Yeah, I just went a few books. I just followed my interest and went a few books into a few subjects. I don't feel like I got a comprehensive view at all.
And I think this goddess worshiping stuff is interesting too, because it ties in with Taoism. You know, one of the things you point out is that Taoism places an emphasis on the feminine. How is that?
I read this article or this essay by Ellen Mary Chan, and she talked about this. She talked about how, I don't remember the quotes, but just through her reading, she found that it was focused on the feminine. And she also said there was a lead she'd read in Confucius about how there was an earlier version of the I Ching where the female
hexagram
was given more
prominence. Yeah,
than the male.
That's interesting. Well, and it's very clear from the I Ching that the feminine principle is equally powerful, and the, you know, the second hexagram is equally powerful. Well, we're just about running out of time, and I want to point out at the end of the book you write about yourself, his book was an effect of teaching himself its content. Has it been good for that?
Yeah, really good. Because for a year, I worked on this every day, and it was all I did, and I'll just read and write about it. And I found that if I just read two articles or even a book about something, I still can't explain it to someone. I need to read like two or three books and write about it and be editing sentences about it to learn about it.
Well, is there anything that you would like to share with our audience about your fascinating book or just in general? Because we've only got a minute.
I don't think so.
Okay. Hey, well, I want to thank you, Tao, for being on the show. There's so much more we could explore about what you've written in your book named Trip, but we have pretty much run out of time.
I enjoyed that a lot. Thank you.
And I want to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.taolin.info. That's taolin.info. And for those who tuned in to the Pathway Show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we have been visiting with Tao Lin, author of the new book, Trip, Psychedelics, Alienation, and Change. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.FM Sunday mornings at 8:30 Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. Thanks again to Tao Lin and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.